Campus FM presents A Book, A Thousand Stories. A review of the book, The Hare with Amber Eyes, by Edmond de Waal. Production and presentation, Patricia Salomone. Musical advice by Gerald Fennec, and technical support by Samuel Attard and Carmelo Grech. As we saw last week, we are now at the turn of the century in Vienna. Victor Efrusi, cousin of Charles, marries Baroness Emmy Schke von Kormela. The newlyweds will take up residence in the grandiose Palais Efrusi on the Ringstrasse, a windingly ambitious street, breath-catchingly imperial in scale, in Vienna, the capital of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Critics opined that Vienna was a confection for parvenus, and that just as the Russian general Potemkin had built a wooden plaster town to impress Catherine the Great, so the city was nothing but a pretense. Hence the term Potemkinsche Stadt. In fact, as he strolls along the Ringstrasse, de Waal tells us, "It is all so self-consciously grand, and yet a bit Cecil B. DeMille." We are standing with our author, Edmond de Waal, opposite the headquarters of the Casinos Austria, formerly the Palais Efrusi on the Ringstrasse. Like our author, we are in awe of all the urns, the caryatids, the columns and pilasters of the facade. We have crossed the large oak door and entered the marble staircase through the entrance hall, where the initials of the patriarch Joachim Efrusi are carved in gold. We now visit the rooms. De Waal tells us the walls were divided into panels, which are delineated in ribbons of gold. Each room has a classical theme. Greek goddesses and muses sprinkling flowers, nymphs pouring wine, and putti everywhere. The fireplaces are massive events of marble. The floors are intricate parquet. All the ceilings are divided into networks of lozenges and ovals and triangular panels by heavy gilded mouldings, raised and coffered into intricate scrolls of neoclassical froth. The ballroom, the Waal writes, has three great windows looking across the square to the Fortifkirche. And here Efrusi express their Jewishness. Here the ceiling is frescoed with stories from the biblical book of Esther. Esther is crowned as queen. She kneels before the chief rabbi, with her servants kneeling behind her. of the many Jewish houses here on the Ring of Vienna, this is the only one boasting a Jewish painting. Here, on Zionstrasse, is a little bit of Zion. But the emperor will tolerate no Judenhetze. The Israelites can count on his protection. Adolf Jelinek, rabbi and philosopher, declared their loyalty, saying that the double eagle was for the Jews the symbol of redemption, the Austrian colors the banner of freedom. So, back to the Effusi Palais on the Ringstrasse. The windows of this great house look onto the building site where the university building is being completed. Victor is the youngest of three siblings, Stefan, Anna and himself. Victor has a tutor, the Prussian Herr Fessel, who teaches him history as the great German empiricist historian von Ranke saw it. History is rolling like wind through fields of wheat, onwards from Herodotus, Cicero, Pliny and Tacitus, through one empire to the other, to Austria-Hungary, and on towards Bismarck and the new Germany. Herr Fessel teaches Victor to love Goethe and Schiller, and to follow von Humboldt's maxim, that the individual is not only entitled, but also obliged to play his part in shaping the world around him. From his teacher and mentor, Victor learns to love Germany, is to love the Enlightenment and its values of emancipation, culture and knowledge. This emancipation means Bildung, the journey towards experience, from speaking Russian to speaking German, from grain trading to reading Schiller.
Bildung is a word in German which is not easy to translate into English. It incorporates concepts that include education, upbringing, enculturation, reflection, and maturation. The easiest way to think of Bildung is as formation. From the moment of birth, each and every person begins an active learning experience, generally starting with the family, moving on to school education, sometimes through university, and on to a form of maturation which allows for a sharp sense of individuality and reflective criticality directed towards the betterment of oneself and society. It is through Bildung that we acquire our intuitive and at times explicit sense of right and wrong. We experience an initiation into the ethical principles which are predominant in our culture, together with the relevant habits of thought and action. Through our upbringing and our initiation into our language, culture and traditions, we learn to reflect on issues that play a key role in our lives, either as individuals or as communities. As educated adults, it is through this process of education, formation, enculturation and maturation that we learn to scrutinize and refine the ideas and concepts that have been handed down to us, which we have learned through both education and experience, and which become open to refinement through our reflective scrutiny. Quite a few German philosophers use the term Bildung to incorporate education and self-development. Hans-Georg Gadamer, who lived from 1900 up until 2002, in his book Truth and Method, uses the concept of Bildung, which he calls a leading humanistic concept. The translation of Bildung in Gadamer's text is self-formation or cultivation, and he traces the use of the word back to Hegel, who already speaks of sich bilden, which means educating or cultivating oneself, and Bildung, when he, Hegel, takes up the Kantian idea of duties towards oneself. According to Gadamer, Bildung comes about because every single individual that raises himself out of his natural being to the spiritual finds, in the language, customs, and institutions of his people, a pre-given body of material which, as in learning to speak, he has to make his own. Thus, every individual is always engaged in the process of Bildung and in getting beyond his naturalness, in as much as the world into which he is growing is one that is humanly constituted through language and custom. As educated individuals, we strive to fulfill our potential and our talents, which are to a great extent intertwined with our language, culture, and traditions. This comes about as a learning process, often through family, educators, and mentors. And this is precisely what Victor learns from his teacher and mentor. He learns that to love Germany is to love the Enlightenment, with its values of emancipation, culture, and knowledge, which encapsulates the very concept of Bildung, an ongoing process of personal and cultural maturation.
Victor, like Charles in Paris, is the family bright one. He can afford to be the melancholic scholar in love with philosophy, for it is his brother Stefan who is destined to be the family banker. On 25th June 1889, Hannah converts to Catholicism to marry the banker Baron Paul Hertz von Hertenried. 11 days after Hannah's wedding, Stefan, the heir apparent, elopes with his father's Jewish mistress, Estia, who only spoke Russian and only broken German. Stefan is immediately disinherited. He was to receive no allowance, live in no family property, communicate with no member of the family. It was a proper Old Testament banishment. And Victor's world stops still, as in a slammed book. Fits with the perpetual dying fall of Schubert's farewell, Liebestod, death from love, was one response. Suicide is fashionable amongst the offspring of the wealthy, terribly common among Victor's acquaintances. Schnitzler's daughter, Hofmannsthal's son, three of Ludwig Wittgenstein's brothers, and Gustav Mahler's brother would kill themselves. Death was Abschied, a farewell to life, and Liebestod, death from love, had a deep meaning. Death separated one from the mundane, from snobbery, intrigues and gossip, from debt and the boredom of life. Thank you. when on 30th January 1889, Crown Prince Archduke Rudolf committed suicide after murdering his mistress, Marie Vetsera, suicide gained its imperial imprimatur. None of the three Efrusi children would go that far. Each, as we have seen, chose their destiny. But to Victor, Victor the scholar, Victor the habitué of the Café Grünsteidl, the meeting place of young writers, it was not any longer a matter of choice. With his brother's banishment, Victor, who had not been groomed for this life, suddenly found himself in charge of a very large and complex international business. Victor had to learn quickly what is expected of him in the financial world. He also has to marry and have children to continue the dynasty. All those dreams of writing a magisterial history of Byzantium are lost. He now is the heir, and he marries the young and beautiful Baroness Emmy Skey von Kormola on 7th March 1899 in the synagogue in Vienna. Victor was 39, Emmy 18. Victor was in love with Emmy. She was in love with an artist and a playboy who had no intention of marrying anyone, let alone this young, decorative creature. She was not in love with Victor. Ten weeks after his son's wedding, Ignaz died and was buried in the Efrusi family mausoleum, a small Doric temple in the Jewish section of the Vienna cemetery. In his will, he left legacies to 17 of his servants, the valet, the butler, the porter Alois, and the maids Adelheid and Emma, amongst others. And so, Victor and his young wife inherited the Efrusi bank responsibilities that laced Vienna together with Odessa, St. Petersburg, London and Paris. Included in this inheritance was the Palais Efrusi, sundry buildings in Vienna, a huge art collection, a golden dinner service engraved with the double E, and the responsibility for the 17 servants who worked in the Palais. Unlike the main buildings on the Ringstrasse, the Palais Effusi had been built by the architect Theophil Hansen for this rich Jewish banker who wanted a building to dramatize the ascendancy of his family, a house to sit alongside all these grand institutions on the Ringstrasse. When she was shown round the house, Emmy, the young baroness, exclaimed, "It looks like the foyer of the opera." Emmy refuses to live in the noble stock of the palais, the floor which had been lived in by Ignace and Emily. It is too ornate, too pompous, too golden. The couple decide to stay upstairs on the second floor of the palais, a floor with fewer painted ceilings, less marble around the doors. Ignace's rooms were kept for the occasional party. De Waal tells us the newly married couple, my great-grandparents, have a balcony view on the Ringstrasse, a balcony view for the new century. And the Netzuke have a new home. So now let us allow ourselves a little frivolity. Emmy, at 18, is startlingly beautiful. She has a sort of luminosity, that rare quality of someone who is at home in the way she moves. She has been brought up in the Ske Palais in the city, but has spent her summers in the Ske country estate of Kovetsis in Czechoslovakia, where she rode, stalked deer, and went for long walks with her dogs. Until the age of 13, she had a meek and biddable English governess. And then, nothing. She therefore has little culture, knows nothing about history. But she is charming in both English and French. And she has her German, of course. Every weekday afternoon in Vienna, since she was 8, she has an hour's dancing lesson. Slim and beautiful, she blossoms into a wonderful dancer, a favorite partner for ardent suitors. Clothes are a passion for Emmy's parents, and they have indulged her in it. For life in Vienna's high society, she needs to know how to dress. As the mistress of a great house, she will spend much time dressing and matching gloves, hats, purses, with the constant help of her lady's maid, Anna. and it is in Emmy's dressing room that the tall black vitrine with the 264 netsuke is placed. It is here that the little Japanese trinkets arrived from Paris as a wedding gift from cousin Charles have a new home. We will get to know more about Emmy and Victor's family menage next week. More about their home, their social life, their children, their family holidays. Till then, my kind listeners, auf Wiedersehen. I thank Dr. Sandra Dingley for her kind contribution to this episode of A Book, A Thousand Stories.